Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. As some of you may know, I just put up an episode taken from the EM cast of Amo Matu with Mac Moyetti talking about KXLate. And that kind of took the place of the MCrit Podcast this week, and that was fantastic. Mac Moyetti is an amazing educator. So if you haven't listened to that, go do that. But I did want to get something with my voice up this week, and I figured what I'd do is just take three listener questions out of the whole bunch of listener questions I get each week and just do them on the air. And if you like this kind of thing, write back or put it up on the Facebook page and maybe do some more of these. Like every couple months, we'll knock off some listener questions on the air. The first question came from Adrian Blackwell, and he asked, in your vent talk, why are you recommending assist control instead of SIMV? He seems a lot of the ICUs in his place are using SIMV. He wants to know why AC? And the answer is AC is the most evidence-based mode out there, and it's really tough to screw it up if you just set it like the ARDS folks would ask you to. So for any folks that haven't listened to the vent talk or just don't remember, assist control, the idea is that the ventilator is set to a certain respiratory rate, and it will guarantee the patient receives those breaths. So if you set it to 10 breaths, the patient will get 10 breaths a minute, and the amount of volume in those breaths will be whatever your tidal volume setting is. So if you set it at 500 and 10 breaths a minute, then the patient gets 10 breaths a minute and 500 cc's in each breath. If the patient's breathing spontaneously, the machine will sense that, and each time they take a breath, it'll give them another 500 cc mandatory breath. So essentially, the patient is not working at all. They just initiate the breath, and as soon as they've done that, the machine does all the work. SIMV actually will still give the settings you place. So if you set them at 10 and 500, they will get 10 breaths at 500. But if the patient is spontaneously breathing, they're doing all the work on those spontaneous breaths. And if they take 20 breaths a minute, 10 of them will hopefully be synchronized to their spontaneous breathing, will be those mandatory 500 cc setting breaths. And then the other 10, the patient will do all the work. Now, you could augment that work with things like pressure support or PEEP and make those spontaneous breaths easy, but the fear on SIMV is that your patient might get respiratory fatigue because they have to do a whole bunch of work. And essentially, if you were intubating them in emergency medicine, it's because the patient was already tiring so much. And so you don't want them having to do respiratory work. That's later on in their course. And so you put them on assist control, and then no matter what, the patient won't have to be doing respiratory work. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I use SIMV all the time. It's easier for the patients to synchronize with the vent on SIMV because they breathe when they want to breathe, and you could actually knock down your respiratory rate and let the patient do most of the work themselves. Now, I'm being savvy, and I'm setting my pressure support to make sure the patient's not having to do a ton of work and they're not tiring out. But as you can see, this is a more involved setting. You could screw it up easier, and there's no evidence behind SIMV, while we have the huge ARDSnet study for AC, assist control. So that is why, for my you can't screw it up recommendations, you choose assist control. So I hope that answered your question, Adrian. If you're seeing these patients in the ICU and they're on SIMV, I think that's just fine. But if they do have acute lung injury or ARDS, the only evidence-based strategy that's really out there that's been shown to decrease mortality is to put them on assist control. The second question was from a gentleman named Corey Brulat. It might be Brulate. Corey, tell me if I'm butchering your name. I think Brulat. And he wrote saying he's writing an article for the EM Clinics in North America, so check that out in the future. And he wants to talk about pre-oxygenation and non-invasive ventilation for COPDers. And he's had experience using non-invasive extensively for the acute pulmonary edema patients, hasn't used it as much for the COPDers. Is there good evidence for it, and does it work? Well, there's probably better evidence for the COPD patients than any other group. And the easiest place to go for this is just go to the Cochrane database and you'll find a systematic review of non-invasive for COPDers. It's been shown to decrease mortality, stave off intubation, really good stuff. The mechanisms are a little different. They're generally not experiencing oxygenation issues so much as horrible respiratory distress and ventilatory issues. They can't exhale. By the end stage, they really can't inhale too much either. Their respiratory muscles are so fatigued, they can't even get a breath in. And if you do see them breathing, it's really dog panting, meaning they're not really exchanging any air at all. And that's when they wind up getting tubed. If you could break that cycle by putting them on non-invasive, then generally they will get better. And especially if you're putting continuous NEBS through that non-invasive system, so you're actually bronchodilating them at the same time. My settings for a COPD non-invasive ventilation is heavy on the inspiratory pressures and light on the expiratory. And in fact, I would usually set my PEEP at very low numbers, 0, 1, or 2, and set my inspiratory pressures higher, because for them, the ventilatory issues are what's really causing them troubles. And if a asthmatic starts desaturating, it's almost always because they're not exchanging any air at all. It's a little less the case with COPDers, because they do have VQ mismatching, they do have whole lung destruction, and they might have more oxygenation issues, but generally the asthmatics, their only issue is ventilatory. And if they're desaturating, it's because there's no alveolar gas exchange. And it's pretty much like that for the COPDers as well. Now, you might be saying to yourself, why are we giving inspiratory pressures? Asthma, COPD, it's all an exhalatory problem. It's that they can't get air out, not in. And that's true up until the end when they're about to get intubated. And the reason these guys look so bad is they're actually at the point where their respiratory muscles are so fatigued, they're not having any gas exchange. And at that point, it actually is an inhalation issue. And if you put them on inspiratory support and start exchanging air, and again, especially that nebulized albuterol and Atrovent air, they're going to start getting better. They're going to eliminate their respiratory muscle fatigue. The machine will take most of the work and the patients will start looking good again. So that's my take on it. Corey, I hope that answers your question. If not, send me an email. And then the last question is not a clinical question. It's more of a philosophical question. It's from Michael Jassenbach. And Michael writes in a very nice email saying that he's been listening to myself, as well as a whole bunch of the emergency and critical care podcasters out there. He actually made this an open letter to a bunch of us. And he said he's loved our educational offerings, but he's noticed the disturbing trend of dogma replacing evidence-based medicine, and that we're trying to teach by referral to our authority as opposed to a good supporting basis of evidence. And he makes some recommendations for how he thinks that could be fixed, with things like interaction of the audience with forums and opening a dialogue. And that, I think, is great. I will say that, Michael, you're right. At least for me, I have never purported that MCRIT or my spots on MRAP are a representation of evidence-based medicine. Now, I am a rabid practitioner of EBM in my clinical practice, but I do not inject it into my podcasts or my lectures. And the reason is that if you do have people doing it, and they're doing it in a short format, like a podcast or a Grand Rounds lecture, it's kind of a farce. And I'll tell you why. You see, what I do in MCRIT is I just tell you how I practice. Now, you have to believe me that my practice is based on evidence. And if you don't, then I have a web textbook called crashingpatient.com where I have every article I've read. And if you go to any podcast topic I've talked about and go to that site, crashingpatient.com, you'll find all of the evidence for everything I'm talking about. But the thing is, what I find is if I pretend to give you an evidence-based talk and reference articles and talk about them, people tend to shut down their disbelief. They're like, oh, okay, there's an article. Now I don't have to be skeptical anymore. And guess what? Me mentioning an article or briefly talking about some points in the abstract, it's a crock. You don't know if the real interpretation of that article is actually as I'm saying, but your skeptic center's kind of shut down. I would much rather do an MCRIT podcast where I tell you how I practice and you listen, you say, this guy is out of his friggin' mind, and you actually go and look at the literature. And if you find out, oh, wow, I've never looked at it like this, he's actually right, then golden. Or if on the other hand, you go to the root literature and you find out this guy's full of crap, send me an email. I'd love to hear that, and I'd love to talk about it. And that's far superior to me than pretending to put out an evidence-based product. Now, if you really wanted an EBM podcast, you got to go to my friend Dave Newman. He does the Smart EM podcast. And each of those lasts about 90 minutes to 2 hours. And that's really only scratching the surface of the evidence Dave talks about, because if he did it in what he'd really need to, it'd be about an 8-hour podcast. So if you want a 20-minute podcast, it can't be an EDM podcast. So it can only be, here is how I, an ED critical care guy, practices. And then if there's practice-changing articles, I put them out there while I'm actually talking. But for the most part, I put the articles in the show notes, or I don't put them in there at all because I want you to seek it out if you're skeptical and get back to me, because that's how I learn stuff too. A lot of the times I think you're going to go to that literature and realize, wow, Weingart kind of knew what he was talking about. And if you don't, then it feeds back to me and then I correct. For instance, the KXLate episode is a perfect example. I've been recommending KXLate for my entire career. And then Mac Maietti comes and debunks it all. And that feeds back. I love it. That's how things should be. So, Michael, I hope that justifies my format. I've never sought to have an evidence-based podcast. I've sought to tell you how I practice. My practice is absolutely based on the best evidence I could find. I read about 60 journals a month, and if there's an article out there on a topic I'm talking about, hopefully I found it. But I am not going to sit here and actually pretend that I could teach all the articles that went into my practice in a 20-minute podcast, because I would be lying to you if I pretended I was able to do that. So hopefully that answers Michael's question, and hopefully that gives a little bit more about the show philosophy. I'm going to stop there. Let me know if you like this and we could do some more, and if not, then I will not do any more of these. And that is all for this week. Bye-bye.